Clemson is trying to sue its way out of the ACC in a move that could have serious implications for that conference. We'll try and figure out what in the world is happening with Shohei Ohtani. And later, we're talking with soccer legend Sam Mewis, who is hanging up the cleats and leading a new vertical at Men in Blazers focused on women's soccer. It's Friday, March 22nd. I'm Owen Poindexter, and this is Front Office Sports Today. Before we get started, a reminder that we are turning March Madness into Merch Madness. Okay, that's a stretch, but we are giving out one Front Office Sports hat every day of March Madness to a listener who reviews this podcast on Apple, screenshots the review, and then sends that screenshot to me at owen@frontofficesports.com. Thanks so much to everyone who already has. Keep them coming. If you submitted a review and now you can't see it because it's still in Apple's moderation process, just wait until it shows up and send me the screenshot. Others have taken the screenshot right before hitting send, which you can do as long as the review shows up on Apple. So, review Front Office Sports Today on Apple, send a screenshot to owen@frontofficesports.com, and you might get a free hat. Clemson has one foot out the door at the ACC. Joining me now to discuss is Front Office Sports reporter Amanda Kristovich. So, Clemson has joined FSU in a lawsuit against the ACC over its exit fees. What's the story here?
It's now the second school in the ACC to pretty much, some have described it as like mutiny because of conference realignment, right? A lot of the ACC schools have been asking, you know, whether or not they should consider their own potential realignment, maybe leaving the ACC, given that even though it had a long-term media contract and stability, the conference ultimately like isn't going to make as much money as some of these other major conferences who have just negotiated new media rights contracts and gotten, you know, new members. So FSU has been very loud about this. Obviously, they sued the ACC essentially like trying to leave a few months ago. And now Clemson is doing a similar thing. And basically what the lawsuits are over is about whether or not the contracts that bind the ACC together are valid. Part of that is a very big exit fee, $140 million for Clemson. Part of it is who owns the media rights to the games if Clemson leaves. And then part of it is just like the fiduciary duties that Clemson theoretically has to the ACC, according to the ACC, not according to Clemson. So that's the gist of the lawsuit that got filed yesterday and some like essentially the motivation behind it.
If the ACC is successful or largely successful in defending this lawsuit or defending against the lawsuit, is Clemson still maybe going to leave? Is that viable for them? Or do they need some changes in the terms here to actually exit?
I mean, I think that's the ultimate question. I think it's going to be very expensive and very difficult for them to leave if they lose this lawsuit, if a court finds that these contracts are valid. That doesn't mean that can't be done, but it does make it a lot more difficult, which again is part of the reason that the schools are looking to do this when other schools, I mean, look, other schools technically weren't violating their contracts by leaving because they were claiming that, you know, they weren't going to leave until the contracts were up. But ultimately, like, these grants of rights is what they're called, are less binding, I would argue, than they have been in the past, in that, you know, people are willing to challenge them and to pay the price. So we'll have to see. I mean, I think that's up to Clemson. It's up to their donors. It's, you know, up to whether or not they can get a bid from another conference. And other conferences, part of the lawsuit says, are scared to even talk to them because of these contracts, right? So that's part of it too.
And if FSU and Clemson do leave, how close are we to an ACC death spiral?
I mean, at that point, I would see other schools looking to leave too. I would assume UNC would be looking, Miami would be looking. You know, those are just couple off the top of my head. I would not be surprised if we saw a complete sort of reorganization and further consolidation into the two super conferences in the Big 12 and the SEC that we already have and that we already see coming. You know, but I also do wonder about the schools that, you know, maybe don't have anywhere else to go. And if, you know, which was clearly not the case with the Pac-12. So maybe that would hold them together. You know, it's like their lack of their lack of marketability is what is keeping them together. I mean, that's been the ACC's situation for a little while now. So, but yeah, I think we'll just, again, it's very much like a wait and see thing, but I wouldn't be surprised if we saw consolidation.
And before we let you go, you're headed to some March Madness games. What are you most excited for to watch?
Yeah, I'm headed to the first and second rounds of the men's tournament in Brooklyn. I always love watching UConn play. As you know, if you read my Twitter and or my a lot of my coverage, I'm, you know, definitely a Big East sicko. But they're playing Stetson, which is has gotten into the tournament for the first time ever. So that would be the most insane upset. It's not going to happen, but it would be really funny. And yeah, I mean, it's just like four games consecutively. If you've never been to a March Madness sort of like setup like that, it's amazing and wild and exhausting in all the best ways.
All right. Enjoy the show. Amanda Krstovich, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay, let's talk about Shohei Ohtani. Here's the story as of yesterday afternoon. An unfolding scandal spilled into the public on Wednesday when the Dodgers fired Ipe Mizuhara, who has been Ohtani's interpreter since he signed with the Angels in 2017. That happened after it came out that at least $4.5 million in wire transfers was sent from Ohtani's bank account to Matthew Boyer, a gambling bookie in Orange County, where Ohtani played until last year before moving one county north to L.A. Boyer is under investigation and his home was raided last year by federal agents. Boyer's lawyer said that Boyer has not been charged with any crime and that he has never had any contact whatsoever with Ohtani. A source told the LA Times that Boyer has bragged to associates in Las Vegas that he has a connection to Ohtani. A spokesperson for Ohtani told ESPN that the player has sent that $4.5 million to cover Mizuhara's gambling debts, and then that spokesperson connected ESPN with Mizuhara, who sat for a 90-minute interview on Tuesday night. But then before ESPN published their story, the Ohtani spokesperson denied Mizuhara's account, and his lawyers said they had, quote, discovered that Shohei has been the victim of a massive theft, and we are turning the matter over to the authorities. Mizuhara then changed his story, claiming that Ohtani never knew anything about the debts. Here's what we still need to know about the Ohtani mess. One, which story is true? Did Ohtani send that money to Boyer himself, or did Mizuhara steal it? Two, what did Ohtani know and when did he know it? Did he know all along that Mizuhara was deep in debt? Did he know the bets were illegal? And three, MLB says that Ohtani is not facing discipline and is not under active investigation, but given everything else we know, shouldn't he be? I don't know how many answers we're going to get, but given that MLB is fully embracing sports betting and Ohtani is a transcendent star beloved on multiple continents, this is edging very close to a true nightmare scenario for the league. Up next, Sam Uys was a key part of the legendary U.S. women's soccer team, and now she's taking her talents into the world of media. Uys is the editor-in-chief of The Women's Game, a new women's soccer-focused vertical at Men and Blazers. We talk about her career pivot, the state of women's soccer, and how the way she was covered by the media informs her approach to her role in the media. That conversation is next. I'm joined now by soccer legend and now the editor-in-chief of The Women's Game on the Men and Blazers Media Network, Sam Uys. Welcome, Sam.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you on. So you retired from soccer and went almost immediately, like a week later, into the world of media. What made you want to make that move?
Yeah, well, a teammate of mine, Lynn Williams, and I had been doing a podcast for 3 years up until I retired, and I knew that I really liked that aspect of the media. I really always enjoyed interviewing teammates and players and even people that I hadn't met before. And when Roger Bennett at Men and Blazers kind of came to me with this idea of really covering the women's game from a holistic standpoint in a way that it wasn't quite really being done the way we envision it yet. I thought it was just an incredible opportunity. And I think retiring can be so scary. So having something to kind of immediately move into has really helped and made the whole transition a little bit easier.
Yeah. And from what little I know about athletes retiring, there's the ones who, like, you know, take a year or two or three or five to just relax, I guess. And then there's people who are like, all right, what's the next thing? Got it. I need something to fill the gap.
Yeah. I had kind of like a long drawn out retirement. I think I hadn't played in like 2.5 years. I was out with injury and I had this big surgery. And I think it kind of gave me a little bit of like a run up of, I'm still technically on a roster, but it started being more and more clear to me that playing wasn't going to be in the future. So I started thinking about the future probably at the tail end of last year and being like, what am I going to have to do to make this transition? And fortunately, Men in Blazers and the women's game was right there.
Yeah, very cool. So yeah, you mentioned that women's soccer isn't always covered in the way you necessarily envision or want it to be. What are you going to cover, first of all, but also where are you going to take this?
Yeah, well, I think that's what's so interesting. I think in this space, there's women's soccer coverage and women's sports coverage is growing so rapidly. And so when I do see other companies covering it, I think that's incredible. I want to be really clear that I'm so supportive of any company that is putting dollars and time and effort into covering women's sports, especially women's soccer. I think that the goal for us was to be the one-stop shop for all women's soccer globally, which is a huge undertaking. The NWSL and the U.S. Women's National Team are such a focus for our American audience, but our goal here is to continue to bring in coverage from the Women's Super League in England and the England National Team. And then as our audience learns and grows and continues to be interested in even more coverage, we want to cover all leagues, all national teams, major world tournaments. We want to have correspondents calling in from Champions League to tell us what's going on. We want to have players and fans from Australia and everywhere there's a professional league being a part of this and feeling like their interests are being covered. So we've started with just a few shows to get us off the ground. But I think the idea in general is to really expand and try to cover the women's game globally.
Do you want it to basically sort of look and feel like the same kind of coverage that men's soccer gets with that reach, but also the same? Do you want it to look and feel the same? Or do you think as women's sports media and women's soccer media grows and expands, it will have a different feel to it? Or even if you, you know, took away the names and couldn't see the faces, you would know that something's different here.
Yeah, I mean, I think in a lot of ways, I love the model that Men in Blazers has created. I think that Roger Bennett's passion for covering the sport that the way he does is it that shines through so wonderfully. And so I think that a women's soccer audience may be unique to Men in Blazers, like traditional audience. Just in general, I think women and women sports fans, yeah, like we our coverage maybe is a little bit different. And I think in a lot of ways, like we feel so connected to the athletes. And I think that that lends itself to really personal interviews. I mean, I've had some incredible athletes come and sit down on my show for 45 minutes and we're trying to humanize them and make people feel like they know them. And I think that in that way, the guests that I've had on feel really accessible. So I think there are elements that in men's sports media, of course, we want to emulate and copy. And I think that a lot of that is really positive. But I first and foremost want our network to be positive and uplifting and for people to come to it wanting to enjoy these athletes and wanting to enjoy their stories and to try to shed a little bit of light in a world that sometimes it's hard to find. So I think being at Men in Blazers is with the right place for me to do that.
Mm-hmm. And you, of course, were on one of the most storied national teams in soccer history. How did you feel about the media coverage you were getting while you were playing?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was playing at a time where it was like a big transition. I don't think I was ever like the face of the team in a lot of ways, and I was okay with that. I do think that there's so much room for growth, and we're seeing this from other companies right now. Attacking Third is doing great coverage. Just Women's Sports is doing great coverage. Re Inc. is doing great coverage. I love that the space is growing. Together is another one. Like, the space is growing so much, and I think there's so much more availability. There's so much more time being devoted to this in a really thoughtful way. And so to be a part of that growth and that movement of the way we're covering women's sports is changing. I think when I was playing, there were moments when you'd shy away from the media. You didn't really feel like it was worth it to have your name maybe be in the headline, or you didn't see the growth opportunity from doing an interview. And I hope that my network and this network we're creating at the women's game can change that. I think that this should be a place that players are like, I want to come on here and tell my story my way, and that they can trust that I'll be able to allow that to happen.
Most of your playing career was with the NWSL. You also spent a season with Manchester City. How would you compare the playing experience in the US and the UK?
Yeah, this is such an interesting question. I think that this was like a few years ago. I had a wide range of experiences in the NWSL. I started playing professionally in 2015. And compared to how it is now, the NWSL has come such a long way, both on the field and off. But I have nothing negative to say about either experience. I think I had so much success in the NWSL. It trained me to be able to play and perform for the national team at a really, really high level. And I also got to go to Man City, one of the most elite clubs in the world, play in historic cities and meet all of these girls from England and be in Man City's facilities. It was so unbelievable. I think the styles were a little bit different. I would stereotypically say that the NWSL is really, really fast. The American game is a lot of transition, and we have such great athletes here in America. And then I would say the game in England is a little bit more methodical. I think that football is such a part of their culture there. There's this incredible tactical understanding. And I was pushed and challenged in both areas that I feel like playing in both is such a, if more players get to play in both leagues, I think that that's like such a weapon, because you can learn about the game from so many different angles.
In European soccer, we see so much cross-pollination between, you know, you can follow a player from Germany to Spain to England, you know, Italy. The U.S. is sort of starting to be part of that network, but it still feels to me as more of a silo. Obviously, we have plenty of international players here, but it doesn't feel like the same, you know, that they're part of the same kind of pinball machine where you see players going around. Do you think the U.S. has to kind of become part of that network more and more to be considered more legitimate in the soccer world?
Well, for women's soccer, I would say that we are definitely perceived as legitimate. Like, the U.S. women's national team historically is obviously one of the most successful teams ever. As far as like women's female players becoming more a part of the network of global soccer, I think historically there have been reasons why staying and playing domestically was a good thing. The parity of the NWSL is one of those reasons. I think that any given week, anybody can win in the NWSL. And I think that that kind of challenge in the games week over week has been really attractive to players who stay and play in the NWSL. And I also just think historically that U.S. soccer has wanted to grow the NWSL and grow the domestic league. So there were benefits to staying and playing in America as opposed to going overseas. But we see some players now, Lindsay Horan is playing in France, Emily Fox is playing for Arsenal. And I think that that's awesome. I think that those players getting to go and have that experience is going to make them better players. They're going to understand the game better. I think having that experience is so valuable. And that continued kind of push-pull of American players going abroad and then players from Europe coming to play in America, I think is going to strengthen the global game in general.
Yeah. And where would you say the center of gravity is in women's soccer right now? And with men's, I think it's pretty clearly still in Europe. Things are growing in the U.S., but a little ways to go, a lot of ways to go. How about in the women's side? I mean, you mentioned, of course, that the U.S. women's national team, I think, is still considered the dominant team, you know, last World Cup notwithstanding. Did you feel like when you were in Europe, like this is really home base for women's soccer, or is the U.S. just as strong in that way?
That's such a good question. I think when I was at Man City, I felt like the culture of the city and of England was all soccer. And that was really, really cool to feel that. I actually think that my experience in the NWSL felt like the American audience was more eager for women's soccer and women's soccer coverage. I think that all of that is changing. I mean, if you look at the Women's Super League in England right now, Arsenal's averaging like 30,000 fans a game. Teams all over Europe are selling out stadiums. It feels like week after week after week. I think we're like mid women's soccer boom right now. A couple of years ago when it was me, I think I would have said the audience in America was maybe a little bit hungrier for it. But now I think that especially with teams from Europe doing so well at the World Cup, Spain won, England made the final, England won the Euros the summer before. I think that that's really, really growing there. And the fans and the audience are becoming so engaged that it's starting to just rise everywhere.
With full understanding, I think that this is not going to happen in MLS or the NWSL anytime soon. Promotion relegation. Would you like to see that in the US one day?
You know what? I think that that's such a valuable thing to have in a league. It's such incentives matter, and it's such a valuable incentive to perform and to invest in your team. Something that is happening in women's soccer right now is that the USL has been granted a Division I license in women's soccer, and not a license, a standing. And that means that they're going to be equal leagues. And I think something I would have been so interested in, I probably need to do more research about this, but would be to see it become kind of like a second tier league where promotion relegation is possible. Player clubs could be connected. I'm not really sure exactly how it should work, but I think that moving forward, the model in most European leagues where you do have that kind of fear of relegation and then the hope of promotion, I think that is contributes so much to the league play and the standings and kind of like the investment that you put into your side.
Sam Uys, really enjoyed the chat. Thanks so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
That's it for today. Enjoy the first big dose of March Madness and whatever else is in store for your weekend. Thanks for listening. We will see you on Monday.